and welcome to Albion Insights. Today's date is Thursday, the 19th of March, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, we're back for another episode of Albion Insights, and we have a very special guest today. We have another political prisoner. The last person I interviewed here was Germar Rudolf. Of course, he spent 44 months in prison for speaking the truth. I've been in prison for a year and 3 months for speaking the truth. And now we have another political prisoner here who has been jailed for speaking the truth. And that is Sam Melia. Sam, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, Sven. Thank you for having me on. It's great to be with you on Albion Insights.
Well, it's very good to be talking to you again. I think the last time we spoke together, you did an episode of Real Britannia with me, and I certainly enjoyed doing that. And I think that was 3 days before I was actually sentenced as well.
Okay, you absolute soldier. You were working right up until until the minute they banged you up.
Well, yeah. I mean, also one of the things they were saying, once I was actually put in jail, they did, like, I was headline news on the Wales News, and the reason why it was headline news is because Radio Albion was still going. I'd loaded it up with a week's worth of content. So while I was in jail, there was all new content being pumped out, and the BBC were absolutely furious about it. I wasn't expecting to get jailed, basically, and I didn't really have many plans in place for when that happened. When they said they were going to jail you, did they wait for a while to do a pre-sentence report, or were you actually jailed on the day that you were convicted?
No, we got a month between the guilty verdict and the actual sentencing. And I did do a pre-sentence report. And I mean, dealing with her as well was difficult because I wanted to be clear with my views and everything. But she was she seemed confused that I didn't consider black British citizens to be white British in regards to the census and like demographic data. And so that didn't really get through to her. But her pre-sentence report said, like, prison isn't going to do this guy any good. He's working a job. He's got a family. And I don't expect his views to change or anything like that with any sort of prison term. So she recommended against it. So when we went to for sentencing, I'd packed a bag, but it was kind of like a not tempt fate. I'd packed a bag, you know, so it's like I'd, you know, two of everything. I'd completely forgot to put a change of shoes in there. And then when we got in there, the judge was just so solemn. I was like, oh no, this is gonna go really badly. So yeah, we went in there high spirits, thinking, all right, suspended sentence. Pretty quickly it was like, oh, we're gonna get this we're gonna get custodial. And he popped in for a minute and then said he had to consider his sentence because it's so serious, and then adjourned for like 20 minutes. So we went back out into the lobby, and I was, my head was spinning. I was like, I can't believe it, I'm actually gonna go away, I'm actually gonna miss the birth of my second daughter, and you know, two years of my life's gonna go by and everything. And and then we went back in, and he did what the judges always do in these kind of cases, you know, do the kind of holier than thou, like, oh gosh, you are a threat to society and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, we got 2 years, but I just stared at him for the whole thing. I didn't want him to see that, you know, this was going to affect me, or it had affected me. And then, yeah, I mean, you had the same experience, didn't you? They lead you downstairs into those cells, and you just kind of left on your own for a while just to ruminate over the major change that's coming to your life.
Yeah, it's quite a shock to the system. And then you suddenly arrive at the prison and you're sort of waiting around, and they're taking you in the van. And I got moved to another. I got moved to two other prisons as well. Did you get moved from the original prison that you were in?
Yeah, I think I spent about 2-3 months in HMP Leeds, and then they moved me over to Hull over in East Yorkshire, and that's where I spent the rest of my sentence. I had a kind of weird, I was in a weird situation. Like, I was classed as Category B, but those Category B, like, high security prisons, they don't take you unless you're doing over 2 years. So I stayed in remand prisons in for the duration, which is probably a good thing, because being a remand prison, most of those in there haven't actually been sentenced yet. So the last thing they want to do is cause more trouble that could, you know, provide a harsher sentence when they finally do go to court. But yeah, it's thankfully I never saw the inside of a category B, because there's some real characters in there, I'd imagine.
Yeah, that was quite harsh. I was quite sort of not a little bit nervous about going to the category B prison from Swansea. I went to Swansea, which is the local prison, which I guess is similar to what you were saying there. They won't keep you there if you get a sentence of longer than 2 years, basically. So you go to you go to your local prison first, and then they will send you off to a prison that is related to your category. And I think all public order offences, all incitement to hate offences, you start off as a category B, and then you work your way down to category C. So I was only at HMP Park for a few months, and then they dropped me down to category C, and I got moved to Berwyn. And when I was at HMP Berwyn, there were a lot of people there that were looking forward to getting down to category D, which is the open prison. So everybody pushes to get through to the open prison originally. And I hear you were working on the servery as well, which is the top job. That is the best job in there, is working on the servery. But I was surprised that you didn't put in for being a mentor. I mean, one of the first things that struck me about the place is all these people running around with t-shirts on saying diversity mentor, old people's mentor, veterans yeah. mentor, like, just there's like a mentor for everything. And I thought, you know, you strike me as the sort of person who would probably make a very good mentor. Did you ever consider doing that while you were in there?
I did, yeah. The classification they put on me, I was classed as a tact offender while I was inside, despite not actually having committed a terrorism offence. But that precluded me from any sort of kind of one-on-one mentorship roles or anything like that. Like, they stuck me in a solo cell for most of my time inside because the fears of me radicalising other prisoners. So also I couldn't get a job off wing. I had wanted to be like an English or a maths mentor, you know, when they assist in the classrooms there. But those weren't open to me either. So I spent most of my jobs were cleaners on the wing. And then when the servery came around, at first it was on D wing in Hull that I first got servery. And then I think they moved me over to H-Wing after the protest outside the prison, basically moved me to right to the back of the prison, as far away from the entrance where the protest was as possible. And I did get on servery there. However, I actually quit because they're all just they were just robbing the place blind. And, you know, you don't want to stir up trouble while you're in there. So I ended up just quietly quitting and just being like, it's all right. It's not for me. I ended up getting back on servery towards the end because all the people who were on it when they were robbing the place, you know, they moved on, they got sentenced, whatever. And then it ended up being kind of like my friend group who had kind of taken over it. And they were like, you know, oh, it's different now. And, you know, got me back on there. But yeah, it is quite strange because you don't think of servery as being a high power job, but it's that kind of like soft prison power where it's kind of like, it's like we, by controlling the food, was it you control the spice, control the universe, and it's like, you know, control the food on a prison wing and you really run things, don't you? It's funny. What kind of jobs were you running while you're in there?
I ended up doing education because I'm disabled. They didn't force me to go and do any physical work. I'm not supposed to do physical work. So I ended up doing education. First off, when I was in Swansea, they didn't provide me with anything. Then when I was in Park, I put myself down for the radio station at Park because they have a radio station there that goes out to everybody's television set. And they were, the prison authorities at first were very pleased about that. And I went along to the first lesson. Yeah. And the guy there, the instructor, introduced me to all the others as this person has experience of this. He has his own internet radio station. He knows what he's doing. And we really welcome you into the group. And I sat in on one of their podcasts first. I said, I'd rather not take part in the first one, but I'll take part in the afternoon just so that I can get an idea of what's going on. And they said, oh, and we get a Daily Mirror every day, and we get a Sun every day, and we've got access to any music that you can find on YouTube that we can put on. And we try not to talk about prison life too much, but we would like to do what's in the newspapers. And I thought, well, that's excellent. You know, that's just what I'd be good at doing, is doing stuff to do with the newspapers. And then I went back there for the afternoon, and they said, oh, you've got to go back to your cell. You've been taken off the list. And I was like, well, why have I been taken off the list? Oh, we don't know. And it then took me someone, 3 months.
Someone somewhere in some office absolutely shat a brick when they saw your name appearing on the radio thing. Yeah,
but I didn't know what it was, because some people said, oh, it might be security clearance. You might need to get security clearance, or, you know, it could be because of my offence. But I didn't know. And I thought they should tell me, and they didn't tell me. And it took me 3 months, and I had to go through the Independent Prisons Monitoring Board. And then I got assigned probation, and I tried to find out through probation. And eventually I found out that, yes, it was because of my offence. And they thought it was a risk, a safety risk, or a risk to the other prisoners, to actually have me doing the radio. And then they moved me to they moved me to Berwyn. And they just before doing that, they cut off all my access, all like letters stopped coming. My emails weren't getting out. When I got moved, I saw that there was a load of books that they had that they hadn't given to me. When I got to Berwyn, I discovered that HMP Park had put a stop on all communication with me. We don't know why. And the counterterrorism officer at HMP Berwyn, she said, look, I don't know why they've done this. They're only supposed to do this if there's a risk of you directing further offences outside the prison. And she said, I'm quite convinced that we can contain your risk element because you're actually in prison. You know, that's why you're here, to stop you reoffending.
Yeah, yeah.
So she said, I'm going to reinstate all of this. You can have all of this back. I'll go through the books. If there's anything you can't have, I will tell you why you can't have it. She was actually very good. And after that was sorted out, then they put me in computer design, graphic design, and I was learning how to create Pepes, basically. And then I did create a Pepe, and they took me off the course again. They said,
you were asking for it at that point, weren't you?
Well, I didn't think so, because I just thought, well, it's an inoffensive little cartoon frog. And they said, oh, yes, but it's adjacent to your offences because it's a nationalist symbol. Yeah, yeah. Nationalism was adjacent to your offences. So therefore, we'll have to take you off this course. But then I went and did music and really got back into drumming again. So it was fine. It sort of pushed me into the music room, which is where I should have been. So I just ended up being in there for my time and getting paid for that as well, rather than doing any physical work. But we're just sort of talking about prison here. I would really like to sort of go back to when you first got arrested, because I can remember Hope Not Hate doing some expose on you, and they were trying to say that you were 100-handers, and I think you got arrested after that. And this, it was the same with me. It was basically Hope Not Hate went to the BBC. The BBC went to the MP for Cardiff, and the MP for Cardiff called for the police to investigate me, basically. But it was all initiated by Hope Not Hate. And the actual BBC documentary that shows all of this, they actually took offline, because I believe it does show that there's political interference to have a politician calling for somebody to be investigated. But am I correct in thinking that Hope Not Hate basically said you were part of 100 Handers, and then after that it was when the police investigated you, which would sort of imply that Hope Not Hate had put pressure on the police to do this?
No, it was funny, actually, because the evidence tranche that we got prior to the trial showed that the counter-terror investigation preceded Hope Not Hate's exposure by about a year and a half, and they'd been doing a lot of work on kind of like basically just trying to trace some way of finding out who I was way back in like 2019, early 2019, late 2018. It kind of begun then, because the 100-handed, I guess, had just popped up on their radar. And that Hope Not Hate piece came, I think it was in the latter half of 2020. And then the arrest didn't come until April 2021, because after the Hope Not Hate thing, I thought it's like, if I'm going to get arrested, it's going to be now. And all that happened was I had a job at the time that I lost because of it. But even that was a few weeks after. But after a few months, I was like, well, you know, I'd always designed the 100-handers to stay within the law, you know, all the stickers I regarded as legal speech and everything. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I haven't been nicked by Christmas. I'm probably not going to be. And by the time the Hope Not Hate piece had come out as well, I'd been with Patriotic Alternative at that point for like a year and a half. I'd kind of mothballed the 100-handers because it had started because of all the censorship. And then here we were, people had kind of got back online. You know, these YouTube accounts were back, these Twitter accounts were back. And myself, I was doing... I was working with PA. I was organizing events. You know, we were doing banner drops, all this kind of thing. So I thought, it's like, well, there's no, don't really need the stickers so much anymore, and it'll always be there, you know, for posterity. So if someone really does want to put up stickers, they can do. So I'd kind of mothballed it. And the other thing as well, after doing it for 6 years, you kind of reinventing the wheel, trying to put out new stickers, you know, just rewording things for no reason, just to keep up with an update schedule that you'd set yourself. So I'd kind of put it to bed, and I'd moved on. I was working so closely with PA. So yeah, when the arrest came, like 6 months on, I thought it was something entirely different. You know, I'd dropped off some Grammar Towler's orders at the post office, turned around, and this huge police officer, I don't know if he actually was huge, he felt huge, clinked my wrists and took me outside, and they, you know, searched me and everything, shoved me in the back of a police car, and they told me it was for distribution of material meant to incite racial hatred, along with like two others, something about possession of terrorist material, and then something to do with like international funding of terrorism. I've been receiving money from nefarious outfits or whatever. Those latter two charges ended up getting dropped before my questioning even began, because I guess they'd searched my house at that point and not found stacks of Saudi money or Russian money, whatever they were looking for, and not found any terrorist material either. I presume the terrorist material thing came from, obviously, Hope Not Hate have repeatedly kind of drawn links between me and National Action, because I attended one public march, you know, years ago. So I presume they were hoping to find like a stash of NA material, but, you know, I was never involved at that level to actually have anything. So that never amounted to it. But yeah, it really was quite a surprise to get nicked for it so long after I'd kind of put it to bed. And then, you know, after that arrest, no commenting through all the interviews, and then being released under investigation for a further 2 years. And it just seemed like nothing was going to come of it. But that release under investigation thing can just go on indefinitely, can't it? I think Joe Marsh has talked about, I think he was under it for a few years for something, and then they just dropped it. So we really thought this is just going to fade away eventually. But after 2 years... we started to press them for our devices back, because they'd cleaned the house out of anything electronic. So, you know, our work computers, laptops, PlayStation, you know, they'd taken literally everything. We're like, I think Laura had she's got like a USB drive that had like a partially finished book on it. And she was like, well, I'd like to, you know, get back to work on that if possible. So once we started pressing them, we're calling them every week to get our devices back. And eventually the sergeant in charge of my case showed up, and he had the kind of the final two charges of intent to distribute material meant to incite racial hatred and encouraging racially aggravated criminal damage, which turned out to be for the biodegradable stickers on public furniture. So it was kind of like, all right. And a date was set for like a year from that point for the trial. So all in all, it was like 3 years after the actual arrest that we actually went to trial. So it was, I was talking to Laura the other day, you know, once I'd been freed back on March 1st, and it was like, God, almost the entire time that we've been together, we've had this hanging over us, and finally we're free of it. So it's been a huge relief.
Yeah, I think with me, they started investigating in 2017, and then I was arrested in 2019, and the court case didn't arrive until 2023. So I was 4 years. I was released under investigation. But luckily, I didn't have any restrictions. When I was interviewed, I was quite happy to talk about my beliefs. They were only they used a tiny bit of the interview in court. I don't think it had any bearing on the verdict at all, to be honest. I mean, but I wouldn't recommend people talk to them. But because I talk all every day on Radio Albion, I thought, well, you know, it's not going to be any different, is it? Really?
I gave the no comment, and then that was brought up in court as to show how nefarious I was. It was like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, for someone to be hiding their beliefs like this. And it's like, no, it's entirely within my rights. And I raised this, and when I was in the dock, I said, it's like, you know, the prosecution was like, you know, oh, you gave a no comment interview and everything. And I was like, yeah, as is my right, you know, and I, you know, spoke to the police officers there and or the CT officers there. And I said, it's like, you know, I consider this complete overreach of the state to have me here in this courtroom now. So I don't think I should be required to explain what I believed was entirely legal and lawful speech.
I think possibly it might have been their excuse for putting conditions on your release, because they could say, well, because he didn't give an interview, we were not able to gauge his threat level because he didn't answer. So we're going to have to treat him as if he is a major threat, and we're therefore going to have to put these conditions on him, because they would have had to justify putting those conditions on. And it may have been because you didn't speak to them, because they knew that I was going to go back and do Radio Albion again. But they didn't put any restrictions on me. And they said, you know, we'll put that you were cooperative. And
they probably learned a lesson from you. And I'd imagine they're probably going to learn a lesson from me as well.
Definitely.
Like, you know, come down like, was it? Obviously, Costello's out now on license. So I think he's had similar restrictions to me, where it's like absolutely no contact with anyone, no internet or anything. So I think especially with you returning and kind of jumping straight back on Radio Albion, I think they want to try and delay your return as much as possible, in the hopes that ideally you'll be forgotten by the time you actually do get released, and also to kind of hopefully break you, you know, cut you off from all of your friends, all of your co-workers and everything. And hopefully by, you know, I mean, I think Costello's license is something crazy, like 2 to 3 years, you know, and it's like being out of the loop for that long. You know, it's like, yeah, it's going to be really rough on some people. You know, thankfully I had Laura. So the condition of absolutely no contact with PA, they had to make a few carve outs for family. You know, my father, Laura. So I was still relatively in the loop. But I mean, if you were someone else, I know the desistance and disengagement guy told me he worked with someone from National Action who had kind of been bemoaning the fact that no one had helped him or been in touch post release. And how I felt about that. And I was like, I mean, it's tough. You know, it's like, you've been done with a terrorist conviction. It's like, basically you're a pariah. No, like no one can touch you now going forward. You know, we've been lucky in that we got public order offenses. But it's like, for those guys who got terrorism offenses, it's like, yeah, they have, you're done, essentially. You know, no one wants to have you in their group or associate with you, because then, you know, then people are getting done for continuation groups. So thankfully we've kind of come out and been able to make contact with people, carry on the work that we do, and only been celebrated for it, whereas other people and other groups, they've really been cut off, and it will break people, you know.
I mean, one of the conditions I had was not to talk to anybody that had any convictions related to extremism, and I think they thought that Mark Collette must have a conviction, because they didn't stop me from talking to Mark Collette. I had named people on there, which was yourself, Sam Melia, Matthew Heimbach. And I think there was one other person, but it escapes.
Heimbach.
God, yeah, Matthew like Heimbach from years ago.
That's a name I haven't heard for 20 years.
Yeah, like, yeah, he's a communist like, oh now. God. He's a communist.
Is he?
A full-on communist, yeah.
how the worm turns, eh?
that's how ridiculous it was, you know, banning me from talking to someone that I hadn't spoken to for 6 years anyway. Yeah, it was ridiculous. But I think then I was talking to Mark, and obviously they knew that I was talking to Mark. And I think when they put the restrictions on you, they must have put that restriction in there. Because once they've made those restrictions, they're not allowed to change them. And I think they may have slipped up a little bit by allowing me to continue talking to Mark if they didn't want me to be talking to people that were involved in the nationalist community. And the other thing they did with me, first off, they said, you're not allowed to go to a meeting. So I queried this and I said, there's two different definitions of a meeting. There is a meeting where you meet people in the street, or you go for a coffee with people, or there's a meeting where you take notes and it's official. Which one of these two meetings do you mean? And they said, oh, we mean the official meeting where you take notes. And I said, so I'm allowed to meet up with my friends, for instance, go for a meal at Christmas with a group of people? And they said, yeah, that's fine. It's the official meeting you're not allowed to do. And I said, can I have this in writing, please? And she said, oh, I can see that you're writing it down there. So you've got it in writing there. I don't need to give it to you in writing. So, okay. Mm. And then a couple of months into my license period, I make a couple of texts to try and organise a Christmas meal. We always go for a Christmas meal with PA Wales. So I'm trying to organise a Christmas meal with my friends, basically. And when I had my probation meeting, and there was a detective inspector there at every one of these probation meetings, as well as probation. And he's looking through my phone. Oh, we can't have this. You're breaking your licence conditions. And I said, look, I was explicitly told I could arrange to go out and have a meal. Oh, I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure about this. And the next week, I got a letter through telling me that I had breached my license conditions, and that just to clarify matters, when it says meeting, it means one or more people. So I'm not allowed to meet more than one or more people without telling them first. And I said, look, that's not clarifying the conditions. That's changing them entirely from what you told me. And they said, well, at least we did tell you that we changed it. Sort of
oh, thanks.
Yeah, that's what I was like. I was like, all right, okay, thank you.
So they're definitely learning, because with me they were extra explicit, and obviously this was after you had been released, so it's like they were really explicit with it. It's like they're, when we say meetings, we mean literally any gathering of people, social or otherwise, ticketed event, public event, doesn't matter. You know, we obviously we can allow some, you know, if there was stuff that I took the kids to that was like a ticketed event, but not political whatsoever. And they were like, if you just tell us beforehand, we can yay or nay them. But they were very explicit with mine, where it's kind of like, no, any gathering of people, whether it's political or social, will be considered a breach.
I think also, I mean, it says that they can just change these conditions without telling people, which will, of course, get them sent straight back to jail. There were quite a few people that turned up in the hostel, and within a couple of days, they were straight back in jail. And to me, it seemed as if probation were worse than the prison authorities, to be honest. Did that seem that way with you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think probation are definitely more... they're more on their game than like the prison authorities. Obviously you're stuck within prison. So barring an escape or violence, you know, they've done their job. But I think there's been a lot of these crimes that have happened by people who are out on probation, and that obviously falls directly on them. But yeah, my probation team, like I got along really well with the staff in prison. And I think the governor of the prison, in his kind of report on me, said, like, I wish we had 1,000 of him, because, you know, he just gets on with his work. He's friendly. He's not making trouble. Whereas the probation team were, I was literally the devil. It's like the most dangerous man. So they were real sticklers for absolutely everything that they could catch me up on, to the point where it's like, I end up having to seclude myself in the AP, because they were saying it's like, you know, any sign of radicalization of, you know, the other people here or anything. And for the most part, I don't know if it was the same with you, but it's like when people found out what you're in for, all they wanted to do was talk about politics with you. And I was thinking, it's like, well, I mean, if any of the staff here hear the kind of conversations that people want to have with me, then there's a possibility here that I'd get recalled. So I end up just sticking to my room all the time, because it's like, everyone there just wants to talk about migration or the grooming gangs or whatever. And it's like, I just don't want to risk going away because some shitlib staff member takes one of these conversations the wrong way, you know?
Yeah, I didn't have any license condition preventing me from talking about things with people. I wasn't allowed to have material that incited hate. And basically, they said, oh, that means anything with that you can get in a library is okay. If you can't get it in a library, it's not okay. And I said, well, all of these two periodicals, Heritage and Destiny, and Culture Wars, Dr. E. Michael Jones' publication from America, they both have an ISDN number. You can get them in libraries. They said, no, you can't have that. We're not letting you have that. You're not having the David Irving book. This is after I came out of prison as well. They wouldn't let me have certain books and magazines because they said that the hostel staff might be offended by them, which was ridiculous. But there was no restriction on me talking about things. I was not allowed to groom children for far-right extremism. however that was ever supposed to happen, I don't know. Yeah. But that was it. No, there was no restriction on me talking about subjects. So what did they say to you then? What was this restriction? Because that seems extremely extreme to me.
I can't remember the exact wording of it, but it was similar to where it's like, I can't groom people into extremism or radicalism. And I initially queried it because I said, it's like, you know, extremism, I understand because there's a legal definition of this, you know, cults to violence or terrorist acts or whatever. But it's like, in terms of radicalism, it's like, where are we drawing the line here? Because some would say, you know, like Restore Britain, are pretty radical in terms of the mainstream political discourse, you know, calling for remigration, things like that. These are all radical, however, they're perfectly legal. And it's like, and I did ask for it to be struck off because I was like, radicalism is just too broader term. You can't define it. I can't define it. So the extremism thing should stand. That's fine. I've never done that in the past, so I'm not planning on doing it now. But they didn't. They kept that in. And it was really silly, but there was a bag. It was the bag I'd taken to court, you know, with my prison clothes in and everything. And I guess buried at the bottom of that, there was some, I think I'd taken it on a White Lives Matter event back in like 2023 or something, like a year before I'd even gone to trial. And I guess buried in there were some White Lives Matter stickers. And I think I had it in my AP room. And I didn't know they were there. This bag has been searched by the court, by prison. It was searched when I initially joined the AP, and my room was searched every 2 days. So these stickers had gone unseen for, you know, months, years at this point. And then I think one search, it turned them up, and they were saying like, oh, we found these White Lives Matter stickers in your bag. And I was like, what? I was like, no, there wasn't any stickers in there. They're like, oh, well, we found them. And the fact that they haven't been found before must imply that you've only recently brought them in. And I was like, no, that bag's not moved since I came in, but they weren't here having it. They were just like, no, you brought stuff into the AP. And they referred to him as overtly racist. And I was like, well, I mean, what's overtly, I mean, if White Lives Matter is overtly racist, it's like, is Black Lives Matter overtly racist? And they were like, no. I said, well, how so? And my probation officer said, it's like, well, you know, black people are subject to racial violence, whereas white people aren't. And I just went, what are you on about? And I brought up a few of those kind of like famous cases, like Chris Donald and things like that. And he just went, no, it's overtly racist. And I end up getting on like a final warning while I was at the AP, you know, like a notice to improve, you know, and if an incident like this happens again, they'll take away my bed and I'd be recalled to prison for the remaining 13 months, I think I had on license at that point. And I was like, oh my God. And that's when I just shut everything down because I was like, I can't have them potentially hear a conversation, because some of the conversations we'd had as well, there was two other guys in there, and one of them was one I'd met in Hull, and he'd previously been one of the hands of the 100 Handers. Like, he'd put up stickers around Hull. So when he met me, I was like, oh, I'm in for these stickers. And he goes like, oh, like 100 Handers kind of things. And I was like, yeah, exactly those stickers, actually. And it's like, I was the head. And he's like, oh my God, no way. Do you know like Laura Towler and Mark Collett? And I'm like, yeah, I'm married to Laura. And he's like, what? But we ended up running into each other at this AP like months later. But I ended up coming down one night and he was having like a full blown argument with a black guy who was there as well about kind of like mass immigration and everything. But I jumped in and basically calmed things down. And by the end of it, we reached a kind of easy middle ground where the black guy understood what we were saying, because we basically transferred the situation we have here in Britain to his home country of, I think it was Nigeria. And he understood that it's like, yeah, if our government was importing, you know, masses of people to the point where Nigerians were going to be replaced, he'd be kicking off and everything as well. So, you know, we reached a fair point there. But I thought, it's like, God, if there's another one of those conversations that a staff member walks into, there'll be no way I'll be able to construe it as like, no, we're having just a healthy debate. It'll be, you know, it'll be me attacking the black guy or something like that. So yeah, it was pretty tense in that AP, but beyond that, no issues. Like, staff members, and like you say, people are in there for like a few days and they're going back out. Cause like the moment they're out of prison, they're back on doing drugs, and everyone was getting caught with drugs in the AP. Everyone was like catatonic half the time as well, either, you know, blackout drunk, or I think there was a crack house just over the road from the AP. So a lot of them would spend all the day there and then come back to the AP in the evening and just be passed out in like seats and stuff. But staff didn't really care about that too much. But like I say, I think I was only in there like a week or two, and I was already the person who'd been in there the longest, because everyone was just getting recalled left and right. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, it sort of surprised me, the number of people that would start smoking again. You say it's sort of people that would just go straight out and start taking drugs again. You think in the prison, you're only allowed to vape. So everybody in prison has managed to quit smoking and take up vaping instead, which is so much more healthy for you. And then the number of people that come out and then start smoking again. And it's like, are you not able to turn that experience around so that it's worked for you instead of working for them? You know, you've succeeded in giving up smoking for 2 years. Why would you want to start again? You know, you're getting something out of this if you don't start again. And it's similar with drugs. You think, well, you've spent all this time off them. I guess part of their resistance to it, to being jailed, must be, oh, I'm really looking forward to when I get out and I'll be able to get high again, and that will be getting one over on the prison authorities and getting one over on the police that put me in there, because I'm not going to stop taking drugs, you know, that sort of mentality. Yeah. And really
for a lot of them, it did seem like prison was merely a temporary stopgap in their just regular lives. It wasn't like any sort of event where you turn things around or anything like that, was it? It was literally just like a year off, and then you get straight back to doing whatever you were doing on the outside.
I did find I had the same experience as you when talking to people. I mean, people were supportive. They would say, what, you know, you're a nationalist, what do nationalists do? And I'd be like, well, we protest against immigration, we protest against grooming gangs, we protest against drag queen story hour. And they'd be aware of the problems with immigration, but some of them would be like, what's a grooming gang? And then you had to explain it to them, and they would be like, how come I didn't know this was happening? That can't be happening on those numbers. And yes, it is on those numbers. The MP said it could be up to 1 million white girls that were raped by these grooming gangs. And then you talk about drag queen story hour, and their minds are completely blown that there would be adult entertainers reading stories to toddlers in libraries, and they understand straight away like what's wrong with that, because a lot of the kids in there, they've been abused themselves, you know, that's one of the reasons why they've taken that path in life. So they're very, very against that sort of thing. And as soon as people knew that, you know, that was my politics and that's why I was in jail, everybody was supportive. You know, black guys were supportive of me, and people that supported Black Lives Matter. And again, you just explain to them, you transfer the situation and you say, look, we're only doing what you guys are doing. We're only trying to do what's best for our people. It's not about hating others. And people support me. And when I first got in there, I met this guy, and he was a crack user. And he obviously wasn't taking crack while he was in prison. And I feel very honoured that I got to meet this guy when he wasn't on crack, because he was a really nice guy. And I should imagine, you know, his family probably haven't seen him like that because he's been on drugs all the time. But he said, everybody that you meet in here has the same views as you. They're all far right in here. And he was right. I didn't meet anybody that wasn't.
Yeah, it is kind of strange, isn't it, though? It's like you're surrounded by drug dealers, violent criminals and everything like that, and it's like they have a better knee-jerk reaction to things like migration, the rape gangs and everything than necessarily your average person on the street. Although, I mean, speaking to average people on the street, and they have similar kind of views to ours, and a lot of the times go quite beyond us in terms of what they do to fix them, you know. But yeah, it's I mean we know what the kind of treatment sex offenders get in prison, don't we? So it's like the idea that that there'd be anything less than kind of like advocating for like violent retribution against like rape gangs, it's like of course they're going to be like that. But to see people, you know, drug dealers who are equally against mass migration, who also kind of, yeah, they see where the country's going and they don't think it's on a good path. I mean, I don't think they're helping that path at all. You know, clearly there's some disconnect between their proposed politics and the reality of what they do in their day-to-day lives. I think that was something that was hard for me to square. Was that it's like there'd be people I'd be friends with, you know, who are seemingly nice people. It's like, however, I know you are a drug pusher on the outside, or I know you've been engaged in like, you know, grievous bodily harm and things like this. So it's tough. It's not the kind of people you'd want to recruit to your cause, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, they have got that sense about them that, you know, you come across liberals who will elevate, you know, these violent criminals is kind of like, oh, you know, we need to be, you know, forgive them and everything like that. But then advocating against mass migration or for white people, and they'll treat you as if you're Satan incarnate.
Yeah, it did seem to me most of the people that I met still had a moral compass. I mean, people that were in there for violence didn't want to be violent. People that were in there that were selling drugs, that was just all that they knew how to do. That was how they earned their money, and they saw it as just like somebody that owns an off license that sells alcohol. It's like a business practice. Just when you were referring earlier to the difference in the way that the probation treated you to the way that the prison authorities treated you, to me it was like there's no acknowledgement of the fact that you are well behaved with probation, but there is that acknowledgement that you're well behaved at the prison by the prison staff. It's like you don't get any positive acknowledgement of the way that you are at all from probation. And one of the other things they have in these restrictions, they have this restriction which is to be of good behavior and not act in any way that might undermine the purpose of the license period. And that can basically mean anything at all. If they want to send you back to prison, they'll just say, oh, you are undermining the purpose of the license period. The license period was there because of your offense. So anything related to that, they could say, well, you're undermining the purpose of the license period. And this was explained to me by my probation manager that they could do this. And that's why it is in there. And that's why it is nebulous. It's so that they can just use that if they want to go after someone, which is really wrong. I mean, I really don't think the probation service is working as it was intended to.
No, but then it's like, but then you do deal with these criminals, and it's like they are basically trying to re-engage with criminal behavior almost as soon as they get out. I think the problem is, it's like someone like you or me, essentially an entirely law-abiding citizen, to then be treated as a criminal is completely, it's a complete shock to us. And this is assumption as well, that we're constantly trying to undermine them and get away with things. And it's like, no, we don't want to go back to prison again. Like, whereas a lot of these guys, it's like for them, prison, it was just another day of the week for them. Yeah, I guess they have to introduce these kind of nebulous rules, because I mean, if there's one thing criminals are going to find, it's going to be a way around a rule. So it leaves the door open for them. And I think what we take issue with is the fact that we should never have been subject to these rules at all. And the fact that, yeah, like I say, we are treated like criminals while we're out there. And yeah, even like complete compliance with your restrictions is viewed with suspicion, You know, it's I mean, they have a word for it, like malicious compliance, where it's like you we know you're doing nefarious things, but it looks like you're obeying your restrictions, and it's like maybe I'm just not doing nefarious things, you know. So I mean, so many of these criminals as well. It's like I wouldn't want to loosen rules on a lot of them, just because it's like, you know, they are free and easy with their hands, you know, coming in GBH, you know, drug dealers getting straight back into the game as soon as they're out. So that's the eternal kind of balancing act of criminal justice, is basically making it where people can be reformed. But also keeping a close eye on those who are just career criminals who aren't going to change. And the fact is, these speech laws just shouldn't be enacted, because it's picking up people who are essentially model citizens, apart from they disagree with the government on policy. And they end up subject to the same rules as, you know, your local drug dealer.
Yeah, malicious compliance sounds rather like legal but harmful, doesn't it? You know, when your speech is completely legal, but the government just decide, well, it's harmful, we're going to call it harmful, and tell the social media companies to ban it anyway. One thing that I was actually struck by was the professionalism of everybody, because people were saying, oh, this guy's a scumbag if he's going to jail you, or the prosecutor is a scumbag. But I was thinking, well, they're there to do their job, and the best you can expect from is professionalism and for them to be good at their job. And the prosecutor was good at his job. Even the clerk was good at his job. I think the judge was good at his job. The National Prison Service staff were good at the job. I was impressed with the professionalism of everything, apart from the privately run prison, which was very badly run. But apart from that, I did get the impression that our justice system in UK, the people that are involved in it, are very professional. Was that your experience? Did you ever think that while you were there?
The prosecutor, he was obviously very good at his job, but he's also paid, you know, like a king's ransom in order to do that job. And I think the idea that, you know, like a regular man or woman off the street, like you, me, Lucy Connolly, for example, it's like has to then go into court and argue with someone whose entire job is to argue this kind of stuff, is it's inherently unfair. And then obviously the way that our British court system works as well, where it's like the prosecution goes first and gets to basically pile up a ton of shit on you, and then you have to dig your way out during the defense arguments at the back end of the trial. So you're essentially starting from, you know, way behind. The trial went professionally, I guess. But it's just a case of, it's like, well, a proper justice system wouldn't be hauling British people up for defending their right to exist, essentially. My probation staff, I didn't feel my probation officer was in the least bit professional before we'd even been released. I've included the emails in my book, but he openly says, like, the difference between you and me is I love multiculturalism. During our meetings, he'd get very irate. He'd want to talk politics, but then kind of fall back on just terrible argumentation. If he was losing a point, then he'd pretend not to have even cared in the first place, or take an opposite stance just to antagonize to the point where he was, you know, once I'd backed him into a corner in terms of like who the Indigenous people are. He was having to say that he didn't believe there was Indigenous people anywhere in the world. And it's like, well, I mean, clearly that goes against kind of like liberal orthodoxy, you know, where it's like there are Indigenous people and, you know, the white oppressor kind of thing. I didn't feel professionally handled by probation. The desistance and disengagement guys, a lot better. But then probation fell out with them, because I think they were looking for some sort of kind of extremism diagnosis, and the prevent team just weren't providing it, because they were just like, this, what he's saying, you know, he's not talking about violent extremism or anything along those lines. So yeah, my probation team, I mean, it's, I presume it varies from person to person. I know the first probation officer, a lady, she was a lot better. I was briefly handled by an Asian probation guy for a month or two. Again, a lot more professional. But for the most time, I was handled by a guy who, I haven't put his real name out there. I've changed it in the book to Richard. But yeah, the meetings with him would be like an hour or 2 hours of just like heated debate. And clearly he was very personally invested in the kind of left liberal side of things and took real disdain with my politics. But that said, you know, he didn't put me away again just because I argued with him. But then it's also be a case of, well, could he justify that? You know, he's got a boss above him, and then that they answer to the multi-agency public protection panel, whatever it's called. So it's kind of like, what can they get away with? But it seemed like what he felt he could get away with is just berating a member of the far right for 2 hours a week. But yeah, prison staff were fantastic. I mean, a lot of them, talking to them, very sympathetic to our politics. And obviously they deal with the reality of it. You know, they have a sex offender wing, at least the one in Leeds, was, you know, overwhelming majority of it was Asian male. So it's like, you can't deny the reality of that, really.
Yeah, there was one or two of the prison staff that I would sit down and have a conversation with. There was one of them who would listen to right-wing podcasts. I think he was a conservative. We'd have quite a good conversation about things, what was going on in the world. But I think my experience with probation was similar to yours, where they would just literally just scold me and berate me for 2 hours and not really understand the points that they were making. They did, like, I would win an argument and they weren't aware that I had won the argument. You know, that happened quite a few times, which is, yeah, that lets down the professionalism, I think, of the rest of the justice system. Is there with probation, and that was the first probation officer that I had. The second probation officer that I had was actually very good, and he was very keen to show that he was not biased to the left or to the right. And I think I could see that he doesn't really approve of these speech laws, but he said they have to go along with they're part of the civil service, so they have to go along with whatever the government policy is. So if you get a right-wing government in, then they have to agree with right-wing views. If you get a left-wing government in, then they have to agree with left-wing views, and they're not allowed to say the opposite. They're not actually allowed to have views of their own, which I was quite surprised to learn. Did you get a psychology report while you were in there? I had a criminal psychologist, like the top one in the prison, did a report on me, which was quite interesting. It was quite accurate in places. And I was talking to her for about 2 weeks. We ended up talking about Star Trek as well. It turns out she was a bit of a Star Trek fan. So yeah, it was interesting. And the first thing I said is, well, what definition of extremism are we going to be using? She said, what do you mean? I said, well, there's all these different ones. I said that the government have just come out with a new one. Extremism means seeking to infringe upon the rights of others. And I said, well, any policy does that, doesn't it? If you're going to reduce abortion, it's going to infringe on the rights of women. I said, before that, they said it means somebody that doesn't agree with British values, and they specified these British values. I said, and then the other one is the dictionary definition, which is extreme supremacism. She said, we'll be going with a dictionary definition, just ignore the others. And you can see it, she's probably quite exasperated by the fact the government think they can change the definition of words. But did you see a psychologist and get the psychologist report? Is that something everyone has to go through?
No, I wonder if, because I was in those remand prisons, they just didn't have a prison psychologist on staff, because it just wouldn't make sense. I suppose a lot of those people weren't going to be in long term. A lot of people got walkouts, so I don't think they were making psychological profiles of people. Obviously, that time you spent in that Cat B, was it there that you had the prison psychologist?
No, it was Cat C. It was much later, because they said, oh, we can't put you down to a category D yet, because this report has to be done before you can do that. And I was quite happy to stay at Berwyn anyway. I didn't want to get moved again to another prison. And it was in my last couple of weeks while I was there at Berwyn that they did this report, and it wasn't all finished until a couple of weeks later.
No, I didn't get any sort of psychological profile. The most I got was the OASIS report, but every prisoner gets that, which just assesses like likelihood of reoffending, which I mean, it's kind of like a self questionnaire you fill out yourself, isn't it? Where it's like, do you have trouble with drugs? Do you have, you know, X, Y, Z? And I was put no to everything. And then at the bottom where it has a little text box, which says, you know, what's your likelihood of reoffending? And I did say like it wasn't zero, because I was like, I was convicted of speech crime. And it's like those laws are intentionally set up to be quite woolly and open to interpretation. So it's like, while, you know, I mean, the 100-handers I engaged in thinking I was engaging entirely lawfully. Apparently I wasn't, you know, and that was all based on, you know, private messages and everything. So the actual content hadn't breach the law. So it's like, well, I can't say 100% going forward, engaging in the political work that I do, that I won't be convicted of something again, because clearly it doesn't matter what you actually say. You know, things are inferred. And then that inference is provided to the jury and kind of left for them to come to a conclusion. So, no psychology report. I don't know. Maybe I was too much of an open book, and they were just like, "It's like, no, we know exactly how this guy works." Maybe you're a bit more of an enigma for them.
Well, it may have been that just the length of prison sentence. It may have not been required for somebody who gets 2 years or under. So I got 2.5. So it'd be interesting to see what James Costello, how his one turned out. And effectively, they said, "Oh, because obviously you've carried out an offence, so there must be some issue somewhere that caused this." And they've got two issues that could cause it. They say you've got character defects, it's a character problem, or you're neurodivergent. And they said, I clearly don't have a character problem, because they could assess me as being extremely truthful in the things that I say. So therefore, I must be neurodivergent, so I must be autistic. Which I found quite funny, just because so many people, like, you know, nationalists do get accused of being autistic, don't we? For caring, basically, for being concerned about these things. Didn't they say something to you about that as well? Criticize you for caring about grooming gang victims?
Yeah, I mean, that came up during the trial, because at that point, you know, in 2024, the state was essentially still denying that grooming gangs existed. So a lot of our trial was spent, the 14 stickers that they'd picked out of the 300 plus that were in the archive, predominantly related to the rape gangs. And so a lot of our defense bundle was kind of proving that they do exist, and also proving that people were talking about them without it being hate. You know, obviously you talked earlier about Sarah Champion, who got in trouble with the Labour Party because she came out and said, you know, there's up to 1 million victims here, and media reports on these kind of things and everything. So it's like, well, if they're allowed to talk about it and it not be hate, why can't me, a regular member of the public? So we went through quite a lot of these reports, and some of them included, you know, what had happened to these girls. And I'm a very empathic person, kind of like the opposite to Laura. She's quite stone hearted, and then, you know, doesn't cry for anything. Whereas I'll get upset over music or a movie or something like that. But I got upset in the dock while we were going through these court cases, and at one point, you know, the defense, my defense barrister said, it's like, you know, so, you know, these MPs, these media outlets, they are talking about it. And I said, it's like, yeah, probably, you know, 20, 30 years too late for these girls. And the prosecution shot back that it's like, he asked me if I knew them personally, or I was related to them. And I said, well no, I've been lucky in that regard. I know, my family hasn't had this happen to them or anything. And he kind of left it there. And I thought, that's an odd. It's an odd kind of line of questioning. And it wasn't until the prosecution's closing statement where he alleged that my tears at the time were merely crocodile tears in order to elicit a response from the jury, because how could someone care that much about people he didn't even know? And I was really shocked. And I thought it showed, it was very indicative of the kind of psychopathic nature of the adherence of multiculturalism, where it's like you can have such horrors happen and not care, you know, because, you know, it didn't happen to you personally. And that was really quite scary to see that they could go along those lines. And the idea that someone who does care must be in some way neurodivergent. And it's like, I mean, surely it's quite the opposite. I mean, autism is characterized by being unemotional regarding these things. And a lot of people who might be involved in the kind of right-wing political thing, you know, it's like, yeah, there's a number of them with autism, but they normally get involved because basically they're very good at noticing trends, aren't they? Whether it's behavior of certain groups or whether it's statistical trends in terms of migration numbers and demographics. But I think for a lot of people, and most of the ones who aren't neurodivergent, it's the personal stories of tragedy that have come about through state action regarding migration, you know, cover-ups and things like that. That was never alleged against me. But maybe they just looked at my profile and went like, well, clearly this isn't someone who's neurodivergent, you know, wife, kids, you know, he works, he's got friends, you know, he's clearly very, you know, that's what I'm known as within the movement, is like someone who's very sociable and gets along well with people and everything. So I guess that just didn't factor into their profile of me at all.
Well, these victims are part of our extended family. I would say it was psychopathic to not be concerned about them. I mean, you'd be concerned about them even if they're part of another ethnic group. You're going to be more concerned about people that are part of your extended family. I mean, that's a really scuzzy thing for them to do.
We can see it with like the Iran war at the moment. You know, it's like people heard, you know, when Israel, you know, bombed that kid's school and everyone was just disgusted with it. You know, no one was running a victory lap being like, yeah, good, 160 girls dead. It's like, no, it's really kind of sick stuff that's going on. And like I say, yeah, it's extended family. And, you know, while you really care about your own direct family, you know, and then it's concentric circles, isn't it? But at the same time, you don't want to see just violence enacted against other groups just because. You know, it's that's just general humanity. You know, it's like it's not being vindictive and cruel to others for no discernible reason.
Yeah, I think also the prosecution, they're not really concerned about whether you're guilty or not. Their job is just to find anything they can to make you look bad. Your defense is like do anything they can to make you look good, and somehow between that you're supposed to get justice. And it's not a good system, but it's probably better than the other systems where the state does all of it and the state provides your defense and the prosecution, which is effectively
that'd be the worst, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's what it's like on the continent
if the state handle it. However, I mean, I had an American lawyer friend who attended I think the first half of the trial here in England, and at one point he got really angry with my barrister because he was under, well, I mean, he's just used to the American legal system where it's like the prosecution, if they were to enter evidence like they did in my trial that was completely unrelated to the 100-handers, purely to kind of poison the well, the defense would just be like, objection, you know, and it'd get dealt with there and then. You know, the prosecution entered this story about razor blades behind right-wing stickers as if that had any foundation in reality. It's literally never happened. I don't know if, you know, if you tried to hide a razor blade under a sticker, it'd be pretty bloody obvious. But it's literally never happened. It's like a leftist fantasy that, you know, that's what the right wing would do. And they entered it into evidence and it just went past to the point where it's like, I actually put my hand up while I was at the back of the court in the little fishbowl because I was like, I'm not having this. Like that just be put out there as if that's something I do or is related to the 100-handers. And the judge let the barrister come up to the glass And I said, it's like, that's just completely fabricated. Like, I mean, for one, that news source, it was one of those like Scottish left wing papers, like the Ferret or something. And I said, it's like, I mean, we can't let that go. And he said, it's like, well, now's not the time for arguments. They're presenting evidence, and then I've made a note of it, and we'll bring it up in the box. And I said, it's like, what, in like 4 days' time? So it's like that's just going to be allowed to take root in the jury's mind. They'll take that as fact, and then I've got to again dig myself out of that, disprove it somehow. And really, it's my word against, you know, like official media. So, you know, what am I supposed to do there? But during the lunch break, we were in like the little breakout room with our barrister, me and Laura, talking to him about what's going on. And my lawyer friend came in and just went off on like the British legal system. And he was like, it's a bloody farce. There's a reason we left and kicked you guys out, you know. And it's like, but yeah, it's it really is. I think there's definitely better ways to do things. And especially in kind of like speech trials like this, it's like so much of it comes down to interpretation and basically just making a character judgment on a person, that it's like the way it works now, where the prosecution just gets to bury you in crap. It really is unfair, but I think that's also kind of by design in regards to these things. And that's why the kind of speech laws in this country just need to go, because the way our system is set up, it's almost like the conclusion has been reached the moment you reach trial.
I'm also wondering there, did you have a jury bundle? Because that entering the evidence in there where it was completely unrelated, that should have been decided before the court. Your brief should have said, look, that's got nothing to do with the trial. We're contesting that. You know, it shouldn't have happened that turned up in the trial and they were using that. I think they should have decided that beforehand. Did you have no knowing that that was going to be in the evidence bundle until it was actually shown?
No, I mean, we had the prosecution's evidence bundle, but what we received prior to the trial wasn't everything. Because there was like an unused evidence bundle as well, and that was stuff that wasn't brought up. But we definitely got some sort of like abbreviated version, because we combed through it, and the stuff like that just wasn't in there. It was bizarre, you know. Like I say, we went through it. We didn't see this stuff because we would have highlighted that as something to be removed. And I don't know if, because it was under the counterterrorism protocol, the trial, and it seemed, apparently that means that everything goes through item by item, like a lot more in depth than like a regular trial would. So, but yeah, there was a few of these things. I mean, there was, you know, like a list of stickers that had been found all over the UK that was brought into evidence. We didn't see that prior to the trial at all. And on that was a number of stickers. I think some had been found kind of Cornwall way, but they had some pretty inflammatory statements. And again, you know, we had to challenge those when it came to the defense's term and be like, well, you know, were they actually attributed to the 100-handers? You know, did they have a number on or anything? And the CT officers had to say, well, no, they didn't. And it's like, right, so you just chucked them in there, you know, for good measure. There was a lot going on that definitely, it felt like we were quite out of control during the trial, because the stuff we'd been given in preparation, I mean, they delayed it for ages as well, but the stuff we'd been given in preparation was not the kind of final evidence bundle, because I mean, they had every jury member had this like absolutely huge like A3 binder, absolutely stuffed with things. And it's like, we had like prior to the trial, like a couple of PDFs, you know, a few pages long each, but yeah, definitely not the full information that they had there in the courtroom.
I'm sure they're supposed to make all the evidence available to you, otherwise it's unfair. Because like the prosecution can use the evidence or the defense can use the evidence, and you're supposed to have access to it so you can decide which pieces that you want to use. So I think they can't have been following procedure to do that, just suddenly just drop these things on you there. I'm sure they must have told your brief beforehand. And there's also a jury bundle that's decided on between the defense and the prosecution. And in my jury bundle, they had Wikipedia sources and Hope Not Hate sources. And one of the Wikipedia sources said that Richard Edmonds, who was the deputy leader of the National Front, was an MP for Basingstoke. Literally said he was an MP for Basingstoke. He's never been an MP. It was quite funny that that was put in the jury bundle. And I pointed this out and they said, well, we can point that out to discredit the Wikipedia, basically, and we're going to say that it's just the members of the public. But yeah, they used Hope Not Hate and they used Wikipedia as their sources. We weren't allowed to use any right wing sources, and I guess because these are considered to be official observers. Did you have any Wikipedia or Hope Not Hate in your jury bundle?
There was a bunch of evidence that was discounted. Well, just basically wasn't used in the trial, because there's like a pre-trial agreements made between the prosecution and defense, and one of the questions was, it's like, are you going to argue that you weren't even the head of the Hundred Handers? And I said, it's like, no, we're not gonna waste time arguing that and make it seem to the jury like I'm obfuscating or anything like that, because I'm dead to rights on that, you know. It's like, it's quite clearly me, and by the time of the trial, I think I'd, you know, been quite open publicly that I had this role. A good chunk of the evidence was like doing like IP traces from the computer they'd taken to the Telegram chat, you know, kind of stuff like that, and even doing like voice comparison between, I think I'd done like two or three podcast appearances on like Millennial and things like that, and being like, well, clearly it's his voice, and I was like, well, yeah, I've got quite a distinctive stutter, so there was going to be no denying that. So yeah, that was all kind of ignored, and we just moved straight on to the actual stickers and my character as a person. I've lost track of what the original question was.
I was just going to say what you were saying there about attacking your person, because eventually that's what decided the trial, wasn't it? Because the stickers themselves were lawful. They weren't saying anything illegal. You've been very careful not to say anything insulting, abusive or threatening in the stickers. But then they found in your social media, they found some jokes, which I think they claimed could be insulting.
Well,
I think that's what,
not even social media, private messages. And like not directed at citizens of color or anything like that. It's like literally just between friends, and like offhand references, you know, to my local corner shop as I probably can't say it now.
Abbreviated Pakistani.
Yeah. You know, yeah. stuff like that. So none of it was like directed towards anyone. It was all in private messages, and they presented these. I think they found about 5 over 6 years of direct messages between friends, and they were like, "Well, clearly this shows you're an avowed racist." And I said, "Well, if anything, I think it's probably the exact opposite. I think most people let more than 5 fly if they get cut off in traffic." You know, so I think 5 over 6 years in private messages, where if I am such an avowed racist, surely I'd be, you know, DMing people swastikas and, you know, the N-word, every other word. But it's like none of that was the case, because I've always tried to internalize a kind of positive pro-white view and not allowed a negative worldview to color me too much. So it's like, yeah, that there wasn't too much for them to go on. However, there was some jokes, and that's what they really capitalized on, was because, I mean, you know, like in jokes between friends, it's like having to then stand up there and explain it to a 12-man jury. You know, it's like, here's the history of me and my friends for 10 plus years. Here's the joke that we made within the context. This means that, and it's like, it's not funny anymore, you know. It's like, you know, take like a professional comedian stand-up set, and you know, it's like, right, explain it to 2 people who we've told you're the worst person on earth, and it's like the funniest joke is going to come off as tasteless and cruel. So yeah, it's it was all about the character assassination, because like I say, it wasn't distribution of terrorist material or it was distribution of material meant to incite racial hatred. And it's like, well, I've been by the time of the trial, I've been doing it for, by the time of my arrest, I've been doing it for 6 years. And it kind of asked the question, it's like, well, if I hadn't managed to do it in 6 years, however I'd meant to, I mean, am I inept at doing it? Because I feel like it's a pretty easy law to break. And if I'd really wanted to, I could have quite easily. And then, you know, alongside these private messages where there's the odd slur used in jest, it's like, well, there's also me messaging personal friends and colleagues talking about how I've organized the 100-handers to stay within the law. I don't intend to incite hate and things along these lines. And it's like, well, if I secretly intended it, why would I hide it from my compatriots? You know, people who, and I mean, there was messages where I was actually like de-radicalizing one or two people who were kind of, you know, really going off on one. And, you know, I was telling them, it's like, listen, just calm down, you know, get involved in some political activism. You'll find that once you're actually doing something rather than just lurking online, it's like that tends to allow people some sort of an outlet, and they realize, you know, not all hope is lost. Like the worst thing for us, I find, is people who think they're backed into a corner and they've got no option other than, you know, some sort of violent expression. I think that's something the state is also complicit in, is denying us any sort of democratic route to express ourselves. And thus you end up with these kind of loners who think that it's them against the world, and they end up doing something really crazy.
Well, you've got no choice but to use sign language if you've been prevented from speaking, body language, you know, you've got no choice but to fight back. I mean, also, I think what's important and what people should remember here is we say that these laws are nebulous, but their argument to that would be, well, we go by the dictionary definition of hate. And you'll say, well, hate is an intense dislike. How are you going to show I have an intense dislike? They'll look at the words hateful, and the word hateful will say insulting, threatening, or abusive. So when you're making up your content, you have to be certain you're not saying anything insulting, abusive, or threatening. But also in your private messages, you also have to be certain that you're not saying anything insulting, abusive, or threatening that is related to protected characteristics. And of course, when you say that to the public as well, they'll say, well, why would you want to say anything abusive or insulting or threatening? And you don't. But it's just that using old-fashioned language, like abbreviating the word Pakistani, that is now seen as an insult today. So just for using that, they can say to a jury, the jury might all support you, but they say to the jury, the law, you know.
And also, this is in DMs. They weren't aware of this prior to obtaining a search warrant, arresting me, going through all my devices. And then they found the content, which essentially they would create this whole case around. You know, it's like it wasn't enough just for the stickers. And I think that's why they seemed a bit let down just after the search. I think they really had hoped. And as well, you know, searching people's devices, we found people, you know, there was the case of Ash recently, it's like 2-3 years old now, but he got 8 years. And essentially he was brought into trial over, I think he'd shared some Mr. Bond, which is like some German musician. He'd shared his songs and he went into trial on that. But they'd also, when they'd got his devices, they'd found some PDF on his device, and they managed to prove that he hadn't ever actually opened the PDF. However, he ended up getting not guilty on what he was actually brought in for, the sharing of music. He got not guilty on that, but then guilty on this thing that they'd found on his device. And it's kind of like, well, I mean, you're imprisoning people for things that it's like you didn't even originally arrest them for. And in my case, the only case there was for the kind of private messages that hadn't led to anything that you didn't even know about prior to the search. It was essentially kind of a fishing trip that they went on when they first arrested me, and they got lucky, I suppose, with a couple of DMs. But I mean, when we went into that trial, the counterterrorism sergeant looked positively ill, and I don't think they thought they were going to get guilty at all. You know, it on its face, it appeared such a weak case. However, you know, you put this stuff to a jury. I mean, how many white people in Britain or any other country basically just have to be told by someone in a position of authority, in this case, prosecution, that, oh, this guy's a racist. And they'll go, oh, right, well, guilty, you know, clearly. You know, it's like that's all it really takes for a lot of people to make a judgment on someone. It's kind of like, it's like, oh, we've deemed him racist. And they're like, all right, okay, well, I'll, yeah, guilty, you know, dropping from the gallows for all I care. But yeah, it's incredibly infuriating to think that of what you're actually putting out there, you'd spent so much time and energy in ensuring that it was legal, to the point where we were able to introduce evidence that I'd actually deleted one sticker from the archive a few weeks after I put it out, because I'd had second thoughts and I thought, it borders too closely upon incitement, and the change log that I released with every archive that said, you know, 13 new stickers this month, 10 new stickers this month or whatever, it said, you know, at this date in 2018, like, oh, I've deleted this because I think it borders too closely on incitement and we don't condone its use from this point on. And there was no evidence of it ever being put up anywhere. You know, no picture of it had ever been taken and published by the 100-handers or anything. And it's like, again, you know, you're saying my intent was this, and I feel like all the evidence points in the opposite direction. However, you've got a handful of cases of a slur used in personal messages, and it's like that shouldn't be enough to incarcerate anyone. You know, it's...
It shouldn't be, but that's the way that the jury will look at it. They will be told, like, do you think this is insulting to abbreviate the word Pakistani? And even if they support you, they're going to have to say, well, yes, that is considered an insult today, I'm afraid. And because of that, that's hateful conduct, which they would say implies you were intending to incite hate with what you were putting out. That's what people have to bear in mind. Be very careful on what you say on your... private messages, as well as on the propaganda that you put out. Mm. Just before we finish, I'd like to confirm one thing, that the investigation you said started in 2019. So it started before your activity with PA. So you weren't arrested for anything to do with PA, were you?
No, and nothing to do with PA came up in the trial, which was crazy, because I thought for sure, you know, like after my arrest, my political output doubled, if not tripled. Like from there, we began doing the demonstrations outside migrant hotels, you know, speaking down a megaphone and everything. And I thought, it's like, well, you know, if the stickers are so bad, surely some of this will come up. But literally nothing in the trial related to Patriotic Alternative. And that came up again afterwards. Was kind of like, it's like, well, you know, I had probation grilling me. It's like, well, are you still going to be engaging in Patriotic Alternative once fully released? And I was like, well, yeah, because it's like... You had the perfect opportunity to bring anything up if any of the work we were doing was so bad. You know, surely it would have come up in trial, but no, it's like my output with Patriotic Alternative was ignored completely. And the only thing I can infer from that is because it all engaged within legal speech. So it's like they didn't want to introduce even more evidence of someone who engaged in lawful activity. You know, they want to have this kind of anonymous sticker group, you know, kind of, oh, that sounds nefarious. He's kept it anonymous. To then be like, oh, and here he is face out on a megaphone engaging in lawful speech. So the jury's going to go, it's like, well, if he had these intentions, I mean, surely he'd be going out there calling people every name under the sun and calling for, you know, violence or something. But none of that happened. And we've seen that frustration with the state as well. I think while I was inside, Gove came out, I think you mentioned earlier, the kind of new extremism definition. And it was basically, it's like, you know, there's a lot of groups that engage in entirely legal activity, but it's dissident, essentially, and even name-checked Patriotic Alternative. And I think they'd love nothing more than for us to, you know, go off on one and start engaging in illegal actions, but it's like, the fact is, no, it's like, we do have laws in this country and we stick within them. So, Patriot Alternative didn't play any part in my arrest or my subsequent trial.
Well, it's good that we make that clear, because people were thinking, because I got arrested, or it was to do with PA, or Sam got arrested, or it was because of PA. I think it's the same with James Costello. His case was all for things that he did before he joined PA.
PA, it was all to do with that creativity movement he's a part of. But it's like, the people have been trying to infer that, and I think it's more kind of like a coincidence that basically everyone who was most active within nationalist politics kind of got on board with PA. And was it, of the thousands who have been involved, what, you, me, and James got picked up for stuff we did before PA? And it's like, and I wound my thing down. Because I joined PA, I was like, all right, that's not needed anymore. And James's was completely separate. And Radio Album was separate as well.
Yeah, I changed from Radio Aryan to Radio Albion a month before I was arrested, which is under Mark's influence.
They'll teach you.
if PA had been going like a couple of years before, none of us would have been arrested, because we would have been doing things legally. And making certain that we didn't have any language we shouldn't have been using in our social media. In my case, I was using language I shouldn't have been using on my podcasts. But ever since then, I've been saying to people, you have to watch what you're saying in your social media. You may have completely legal propaganda that you're putting out there, but if you've got slurs in your social media, that means that they will say that your intent on putting out that lawful media was to incite hate, and a jury will have to find you guilty because you're using what they term as hateful language there. It's hopefully
this idea of having like a hidden agenda, and it's like, and that's why I say it's really important to internalize more of a pro-white view than a negative other view, because it's like they're not above going on these fishing trips and picking you up for something that they know stays within legal grounds. However, it's a bit touch and go, and it's like all it takes is for them to comb through your social media, which you thought was private, or your DMs, which you would assume were private, and from that kind of paint a picture of you as again with that kind of malicious compliance. It's like you were complying with the law, but secretly you wanted to break it, and that's how they get you.
That's absolutely spot on. We have to keep positive at all times. Well, I know that you're going to have to get going, Sam. I'm sure we could continue talking all day. Thank you very much for coming on today. Is there any messages that you would like to finish with? I know that you've written a book that you'd like to plug, and also, where can people contact you?
I'm contactable on Telegram, and I've even got a Twitter now. We've reactivated after being away, and it seems to still be up, which is quite good. I kept a prison diary while I was away, and the kind of first half of it is the kind of crazy stuff that happens in prison, which I'm sure you know about. But then the second half is a lot of it is the conversations with the probation team and the desistance and disengagement program, and what kind of arguments they present. And the refutation of a lot of those arguments, and the, how heated it got. But I think it's pretty entertaining. But it's called Legal, Truthful and Guilty. Pre-order is open now. I think when this airs, I think we'll only be a short week away from release as well. But that can be, you can pre-order it at grandmatowlers.co.uk. That's my wife and I's tea and coffee business. And then upon release on the 24th, it'll also be available on Amazon as well for any foreign listeners who want to save on postage or anything like that. But it's been fantastic being on, Sven, and I look forward to eventually a kind of three-way podcast between you, me and James in a few years' time.
Yeah, I look forward to that. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. So thanks once again for coming on. Thank you, listeners, for listening, and watch out in the future for more episodes of Albion Insights.